This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield approval. If you qualify and if rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. To learn more, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Bud Mishkin, and this is On Point. We live in a world that seems to move faster than ever, both exciting and exasperating. As the pace of our lives speeds up, many of us are looking for moments to slow down. More and more of us are practicing mindfulness. Jon Kabat-Zinn is widely considered the founder of modern mindfulness. He believes the practice could provide the answer that many are looking for in an era of smartphones, 24-hour news cycles, and social media. This hour, On Point, mindfulness. What it is, and how it's changing lives from the cubicle to the classroom. You can join us on air or online. Is mindfulness a part of your daily routine? Has it helped you through tough times? Do you meditate? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Woods Hole, Massachusetts, is Jon Kabat-Zinn, professor of medicine emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He's also the creator of the mindfulness-based stress reduction program. His new book is Falling Awake, How to Practice Mindfulness in Everyday Life. It's the second in a series of four books with updated forewords featuring work previously published in Kabat-Zinn's 2005 book, Coming to Our Senses. For an excerpt, you can go to our website, onpointradio.org. Jon, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Bud. It's a pleasure to be here.
It is no hyperbole to say that more than a few people in my family and my friends, people stopping me on the street when they found out that I was doing a segment about mindfulness, said to me with great intent, "This is important." Translated, "Don't mess it up." It is remarkable how many people are connected at this point to mindfulness, which leads to my first question. You've been at this for a long time. Are you surprised by how much the idea of mindfulness and the term has kind of infiltrated the culture?
Well, the answer to that, Bud, would be yes and no. I'm not surprised so much as delighted, but since I've been at this for well over 40 years, my intention from the very beginning in founding the MBSR, or Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Clinic at the UMass Medical Center, was to actually give a kind of a proof of concept that meditative awareness was actually something that regular mainstream Americans could take up and derive profound benefit from. And so the intention from the very beginning, also being trained as a scientist at MIT, was to actually establish, if it was there, a scientific foundation and development of a kind of validity for understanding what meditation is, how it can be applied in everyday life, how it can be valuable to people suffering from horrendous levels of stress, pain, and illness. And that was back in 1979, when the stress was a lot less than it is now. So I'm not surprised, really. And I want to underscore that I'm delighted, even though it's also true that there's a certain degree of hype that inevitably surrounds anything that becomes popular, and then more and more people claim to understand what it is when they really don't, or they only consider it from a conceptual level, which, if mindfulness was only about a conceptual level or theoretical understanding, it would be of virtually no value.
Before we get to how people practice mindfulness today and what that means and how it manifests itself, a bit of the history. Those understandings that you were just referring to, did you come to them gradually as a man of science, or is there a seminal moment where it starts to click in for you that this is something important and this goes far beyond just private meditation?
Yeah, well, again, the answer is in some sense both, and I've examined my own, you know, historical trajectory in this regard. So there was a kind of yearning when I was a graduate student in molecular biology at MIT for a deeper understanding of the nature of sentience, the nature of consciousness, how we go from biology to awareness to you know, living a life that has an inner and an outer dimension to it. So that was a kind of in a sense, love affair with science and the whole question of what it means to be human. That's still very much alive for me. But I've also had experiences on various retreats, one of which I wrote about, that that really inspired the beginnings of MBSR 40 years ago by recognizing the potential for this to not be of value just for a few people that are interested in, you know, monasticism or yoga or meditation, but for the mainstream of humanity and, in fact, for the species as a whole. And we can get into that, if you like, further down the road.
Can you flesh out for me the notion of mindfulness in terms of science and mindfulness in terms of spirituality? From your point of view, do they coexist, or is there any knocking heads as far as those two things are concerned?
Good question. I try to avoid the word spirituality altogether in associating it with either meditation or mindfulness, because everybody has such different ideas about spirituality that it actually becomes divisive and a little bit woo-woo and not that clear what we even mean by it. So my working definition of spirituality is what it means to be truly human or really human. And I leave it at that. So is having a baby a spiritual experience? Well, it depends on how you relate to it. Is chopping vegetables a spiritual experience? Well, it depends on how you are in relationship to it. And what mindfulness does is it rounds out the multidimensionality of relationships itself. So I call that relationality. And that's what awareness is, like our fundamental characteristic of being human, is that we have awareness. It's not something we have to attain or achieve, but we don't get any schooling in how to inhabit it. So we're lost in thought a great deal of time and driven through our moments to get to better moments at some future time.
It's an interesting point about definition. Spirituality in our house often came back to food. So eating pesto in Italy or...
Hey, spiritual experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Even if you've never heard of mindfulness, there's a chance you've encountered mindfulness beliefs before. Here's a classic line from actor Matthew Broderick playing, yes, Ferris Bueller in the iconic 1986 film Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Here we go. I'm talking to a man of science, a man who's connected to this notion of mindfulness for so many years, admired by so many, and I bring out the Ferris Bueller clip. But in this day and age, as we get more and more into, as you saw us, the society get more and more into social media and cell phones and so on, is there a particular moment where you start to recognize, wow, things are really changing in this society and actually across the world, and how does mindfulness pertain in this world of cell phone, 24-hour news, and social media?
Well, that's a fabulous question, because in some sense, we're all living like the proverbial frog in the pot of water, which is, has a giant flame underneath it. And the transition from an analog world, 20 or 30 years ago, to a more and more increasingly digital world is actually driving all sorts of different problems in our society, as well as beauty, because you can't live without the technology in some ways, and it's hard to live fully with it. So we're perpetually distracted now and capable of distracting ourselves infinitely because we've got these supercomputers in our pockets, and we don't necessarily just use them as phones or even for texting. We're constantly checking our email or our Instagram account or whatever, and how many people liked me on Facebook or liked my post. And it's driving us in some sense nuts. And I think, has the potential to actually addict us. And I know the people who developed or led the team for Apple that developed the iPhone, Tony Fadell, and they developed it in their 20s, all these young engineers, to be maximally seductive and maximally addictive, and they did a fabulous job. Yes. But none of them had kids at the time, and now they see the problem of it, and Tony Fadell is actually quite articulate about the dangers associated with his own invention and how important it is to find ways to liberate oneself, which is really a meditative language, but to liberate oneself from the enslavement, so to speak, of that kind of addictive, always looking someplace else for something to make the moment better instead of realizing the beauty of the moment that you already are in.
John, let's try and get a call in before we take a break, and we'll start with Paul, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Paul, welcome to On Point.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I discovered mindfulness several years ago in Afghanistan, and I discovered the Jon Kabat-Zinn program through a friend. And since then, I've been medically retired with disabling PTSD, and mindfulness has truly saved my life. It's really been one of those key components that has just become an integral part of my life, to where I actually, you know, deliberately make time during my day where I integrate it in the morning and I integrate it in the evening before bed. And it's really just been a true lifesaver.
John, did that, Paul, did that start while you were still in Afghanistan or only when you got back to the States?
No, it started in Afghanistan through a friend of mine who had taken classes through UMass, through the MBSR program, which I'm currently in now and have taken several. And at first I thought to myself, you know, with everything going on, you know, with rocket attacks and so on and so forth, how could this possibly help? And the more that I opened my mind up to it and started getting into it, the more that I saw the positive effects of it. And even after departing Afghanistan, it just really became an integral part of my life.
Paul, thank you for sharing your story, and of course, thank you for your service as well. John, are there moments, about 20 seconds before we go to break, are there instances where you wonder, will mindfulness help this particular person?
Well, I'm just so touched by what Paul has shared, and perhaps the best thing to say is let's come back to it at the other side of the break.
Okay. We're discussing mindfulness and how it can help keep you grounded in our fast-paced world. You can join the conversation. Can you achieve inner peace with mindfulness? Are you a skeptic? We are discussing this with Jon Kabat-Zinn. He is the creator of mindfulness-based stress reduction, a professor of medicine emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. I'm Bud Mishkin. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing their all-new Rate Shield approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Quicken Loans will lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states, NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, this is Stretch Armstrong.
And this is Bobbito Garcia, the hosts of What's Good.
We're back with a brand new season.
We've got Erykah Badu, Lenny Kravitz, Black Thought, and more.
You'll hear B-side stories from A-list guests. Subscribe now.
This is On Point. I'm Bud Mishkin. We're talking about mindfulness and how you can incorporate it into your daily life. Is mindfulness meditation? Is there a difference? What's your favorite way to meditate? What else do you do to cultivate mindfulness? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our guest, Jon Kabat-Zinn, professor of medicine emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Medical School and the creator of the mindfulness-based stress reduction program. His new book is Falling Awake, How to Practice Mindfulness in Everyday Life. I think it's safe to say in the mid-70s, the word mindfulness was not part of the vocabulary, but meditation was. And that subject was addressed by the great comedian Robert Klein in this clip from his 1974 album Mind Over Matter.
Americans are willing to meditate, but it's always got to be on their own terms. Can they accommodate it to their own convenience? They want to know, can you smoke when you meditate? You know, I'm divorced. Can I still meditate? A girlfriend told me that I couldn't. Can you meditate on the toilet? It would save me endless time. I was wondering if I could combine the two.
The great Robert Klein, his comedy always funny, always insightful. John, through the years, did you have to deal with a lot of skepticism as this was first starting out? Or was that not so much an obstacle to overcome?
That's fabulous. Just the riff on on meditation. And, you know, surprisingly, I didn't encounter any kind of pushback in the medical world around what I was doing, or in the more mainstream world. Certainly athletes know right from the get-go that, you know, they're often defeated, or, you know, their performance is eroded by their own minds rather than their skill sets on the physical level. And the words medicine and meditation are linked at the etymological hip. And so there's a certain way in which I think, partly because I'm a scientist, that it kind of let me do what it was that I, you know, proposed doing. And then they saw the results in it with their patients. So I want to emphasize that we're not actually trying to sell anybody on anything. But when people are falling through the cracks of the healthcare system, or feeling traumatized, or coming back from war zones, you know, and there are limits to what drugs and surgery and other kinds of psychological treatments can do, challenging people to do something for themselves that nobody else on the planet can do for them, mobilizing deep interior resources that we all already have by virtue of being human, and then discovering in that process, which is a certain kind of discipline, just like going to the gym, that it can transform your relationship to your own suffering, to your own pain, emotional or physical, or to your own mental processes, as well as the outer domains of the world, family, work, life, even economics and politics. That's a kind of profound discovery of a form of human intelligence that has been, you know, inside of us for, you know, thousands and thousands of years. And now, in some sense, is emerging, because I think we're, if not dying, at least starving for some kind of authentic human experience that doesn't have to do with distraction or being entertained, or, as it's often put, diverted, divertissement, French for entertainment, away from the actuality of our lives. And that's a beautiful kind of the thing that keeps me going is people like Paul and people that I meet every day who say, you know, just what he said, mindfulness saved my life. I do think, Bud, that we should probably, for your listeners, maybe define what we mean by mindfulness at this point in the program.
Well, is that okay? Is that kind of a moving target through the years as to what the definition actually is?
It really has not been a moving target, at least for me. I mean, lots of people have their own views of it. And maybe I should back up and just say, I didn't make up mindfulness. A lot of people might think that, but mindfulness is often spoken of in the Buddhist tradition as the heart of Buddhist meditation. It's the Buddha himself spoke about it as the direct path to liberation from suffering. But the Buddha wasn't a Buddhist, and in a very real way, what he was like a doctor or a laboratory scientist who discovered certain aspects of the mind that are kind of like laws of physics, laws of gravity, you know, that, so if, for instance, you attach to a particular kind of something as I, me, or mine, and you build a big story around it, that is a guaranteed prescription for suffering.
Let's go back to some phone calls now. We have plenty. Rob is calling from Rexburg. I'm sorry. Rob, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment that mindfulness has been really instrumental in me being able to do some of the traveling that I need to do between work and leisure. About a year ago, wound up on a plane with my wife and kids, and had just kind of a panic attack kind of meltdown. And I've always suffered from a little bit of fear of flying, and I got really concerned, and so my wife had suggested that I try mindfulness. And I've now been, I think, on three or four different flights, and it's been quite remarkable. It's not to say that, you know, there aren't times that I don't get a little uptight, but, you know, that deep-set fear, you know, panic response has just been absent. And more recently, even my junior high school age, one of my junior high school age children has started using mindfulness meditation. She's quite anxious as well, and it allows her to get to sleep at night. So
Bob, could I ask you how you actually use mindfulness when the anxiety comes up in the plane?
So I usually, I've got a program or an app on my phone that I use, and I will usually just have some background. There are some bells and some sort of cello or violin type, well, cello type music mm-hmm. playing in the background. And I just try to focus on what I'm experiencing at that specific moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, feeling myself sitting there in the chair,
mm-hmm.
You know, the focusing on my breathing, focusing on the some of the physical sensations that I'm getting, you know,
right.
Whatever the case may be.
Beautiful. And, so you're actually putting out the welcome mat for how you're feeling and then being in a relationship to it that doesn't sort of catapult you into even more anxiety.
Rob, as a fellow anxious flyer, I admire what you've done, and I should probably follow your path for the next time I get on the next plane. John, you have used the term, let's see if I got it right, in some of your writings, in talking about people taking mindfulness and perhaps extending it to places it shouldn't go or using it in an improper way, you've used the term mic-mindfulness. Can you flesh that out for us, please?
Well, I didn't actually coin that term, okay. and I don't love it, but I do think it's pointing at something that I alluded to earlier, and that is the hype that when something becomes very much a hot topic in the mainstream, or even in the mainstream of psychology, then everybody with a PhD in psychology thinks that, you know, they already do it because it's just awareness. And, you know, I mean, I can figure that out. And what they don't understand, and I didn't emphasize this yet, is that mindfulness really is a form of meditation. And it's actually virtually the hardest thing in the world to actually string two moments of presence together, of non-reactive, non-judgmental presence. But non-judgmental doesn't mean you won't have judgments. It means that you'll have tons of judgments and reactivity, but you won't judge that. And that's exactly what Rob was doing on the airplane. You see, and this provides that kind of opening, that degree of freedom where you can actually change your relationship to the unwanted arisings in your life, stress, pain, illness, and so forth. And anyone can do it. There's no magical one right way to do it. It's not like you have to do it this way, but there are an infinite number of wrong ways to go about it too. And one of them is misconstruing mindfulness as just being in the present moment. That's really hard to do. You need to exercise the muscle. And that means in some sense, really practicing on a regular basis more than you might even feel like it. And then befriending your mind in ways you never would have believed possible.
Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Thomas Joyner is professor of psychology at Florida State University and the director of the university's psychology clinic. He published the book Mindlessness, The Corruption of Mindfulness in a Culture of Narcissism. That book was published last year. Thomas, thank you for joining us on Point.
Well, hello, Bud. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. You've written, and I hope I got the quote correct, that true mindfulness is being usurped by an imposter. How do you mean?
I think it refers to the same hype phenomenon that Dr. Kabat-Zinn has referred to a couple times. The benefits of mindfulness are plain. They exist, and Dr. Kabat-Zinn and others have documented those rigorously, but I think they have been exaggerated. I think they've been hyped. I don't see much convincing evidence that the interventions related to mindfulness outperform very mundane, very healthy behaviors such as regular exercise, going to the gym, walking, things like that. So that's really one of my main concerns in that book is the exaggeration phenomenon, the overhyping phenomenon. That's not necessarily the movement's fault. It's, you know, other people coming in and doing that, but it's a real problem that I do think needs to be addressed.
You've also written, essentially, and I'm paraphrasing here, and hopefully correctly, that in moderation, mindfulness is good, but among, I believe, as you put it, incredibly self-interested creatures, it can court excess. How so? What do you see on the ground?
Well, I do think that the original, you know, authentic, down-to-earth version of mindfulness has a lot of merit, and it makes a lot of sense, and it's very useful to people. I am concerned, though, and the book is preoccupied, really, with the problem that the culture of the self, the culture of narcissism, has gotten intertwined with mindfulness and redirected its focus too much towards the self, at least with regard to my understanding of it. It's really not about the self. The Buddha, I don't think, was very concerned about himself, for example.
That's totally true.
Yeah, and so I'm really worried about that pull of the culture on mindfulness toward narcissism. Here again, it's not really mindfulness's fault. It's a cultural thing that's affecting many things, including mindfulness, is at least one point of my book.
There is one quote that I got a chuckle out of, where you refer to pleasant activities and basically saying that some of these events or things that you're talking about that people coined as being part of mindfulness were just pleasant activities, and we call pleasant activities pleasant activities. Have you seen that from your vantage point, and then John will get your response, have you seen that, is that a of recent ilk, or is this something that's gradually you've paid attention to through the years and been concerned about?
Well, it's really become quite a phenomenon within psychology and other sectors of healthcare. I'm a psychologist. My specialty is not on mindfulness. It happens to be on something else, suicide prevention, as it so happens. But I am a generalist, you know, mental health practitioner, in my case, a clinical psychologist. And so I see these trends, and this one, I think, caught my eye to the point that I thought it was problematic enough that it deserved a book-length treatment of these processes, which I think are a shame, because there's something there with mindfulness that's useful. I just don't want it to be overhyped, exaggerated. I don't want it to be distorted into something having to do with self-regard or narcissism. Unfortunately, I think that's happening.
John, through the years, has this, from the origin of this and your thoughts about it, through the years, have there been suggestions, criticisms might be harsh, but that you've taken into account and said, okay, this is what we've got right now, this is how we could improve it in terms of our thinking? Is it kind of malleable, or are the truisms about what you think is mindfulness, are they kind of set in stone?
I feel that Dr. Joyner is making some very, very interesting points that really are going to become more and more relevant the more this thing grows. So the challenge is to not throw the baby out with the bathwater, or even recognize that there is a baby there. And it requires a certain kind of tending and tenderness and attention that has nothing to do with the kind of narcissistic hype that you do see on the internet, especially, which is one reason to not spend so much time on the internet. But it is diagnostic of something in our society. So I'll just say that one of my intentions to, you know, bring mindfulness into the mainstream of the world wasn't just to have some nice therapy in medicine or in psychology. It was actually, as I said, a demonstration, so to speak, or a proof of concept that this could have profound repercussions in every aspect of human life. And that would include the political, the economic, the social in many different ways, the outer world, if you will, as opposed to merely the world of our own interiority, which is where the risk of narcissism comes in. But actually, in meditation training, when you look deeply into the nature of self, you find that you can't discover a self nature, that no matter what you look, it's just form and emptiness. And this is something that people discover for themselves as they get more and more deeply into the practice. But it's not like losing yourself. It's discovering that your narrative of who you are is so much too small for the actuality of what you are as a human being in relationship with the entire world. And I think that that's going to be, in some sense, the fulcrum for transforming the species into the name we gave ourselves originally, Homo sapiens sapiens, so that we can actually find some kind of sanity on this planet and not destroy ourselves in the next few decades.
Professor, have about a minute left in this segment. In dealing with patients through the years, do you find that the phrase comes up more often and that you're put in a position of here's how it can work, but here are the traps you shouldn't fall into?
No, I think that in general, my experience is that when you're suffering, you don't care about that second order stuff. You just want something that's going to actually work. And that's the verb that people will use, that really works. And as those callers have called up and said, you know, this has had a profound effect in their lives because they actually were open enough to give it a try. It's never about anything else. It's about the full dimensionality of who I am, who you are as a human being. Mm.
Thomas Joyner is a psychology professor at Florida State University and the author of Mindlessness, The Corruption of Mindfulness in a Culture of Narcissism. Professor, thank you for joining us on Point.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We're discussing mindfulness and the evidence for a practice that has exploded across the globe. You can find the conversation. Do you think living in the now works? Could mindfulness help us all slow down a little bit? I'm Bud Mishkin, and this is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
So you just woke up and you want to find out about the latest news. That is when you turn to Up First, the 10-minute news podcast from NPR News. Here, Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Bud Mishkin. We're talking mindfulness and how meditation can be integrated into public places, from schools to the workplace. And you can join the conversation. Do your children practice mindfulness in their classrooms? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Jon Kabat-Zinn, professor of medicine emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Medical School and creator of the mindfulness-based stress reduction program. His new book is Falling Awake, How to Practice Mindfulness in Everyday Life. And now joining us from Clear Lake, Iowa, is Rupa Mehta. She's a fitness instructor and creator of the Nalini Kids program, which teaches nearly 100,000 students across New York City how to improve both their physical and emotional health. Rupa, welcome to On Point.
Hi. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
So the notion of taking this idea of linking physical health and emotional health and bringing it into the schools as your program does, what is the origin of that for you?
I think it boils down to this discipline of connection, that if you feel connected to your teacher and your environment, then you're going to have a more ripe learning experience. And there are barriers to connection for adults and students alike in the classroom, whether they be physical barriers or emotional barriers. So our program aims to tackle those barriers through very specific workouts so that they feel connected to their classroom and the learning experience.
I've seen your program in action and you leading it in Brooklyn, New York. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me how it manifests itself? And when you're talking to kids, and what age range are we talking about here? Can I imagine that the notion of being physically fit, okay, they understand that. Is the emotional side of it, is that a tough sell, or do kids get that immediately?
It's not a tough sell. And actually, I would say the best way to describe how this manifests is that, you know, we have this age-old question we always ask children of, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And our aim in our program is to flip that question and be more specific and ask students, who are they now and what can you teach us? And in order to successfully answer that question, students need to know who they are emotionally and physically, feel safe to be connected to that. And once you start making a language that's universal, that feels approachable, students walk right into sharing their emotional and physical barriers because they feel connected to their teacher and their environment.
How long have you been doing the program?
10 years.
Okay. Again, comparing the initial stages of the program to what you experience now when you walk into a school, is there a difference based on society, based on social media, based on cell phone, that for whatever reason, young people look at emotional health differently than they did when you first started the program?
I think young people are so influenced by their teachers in the room. So I would say both teachers and students alike feel their, you know, I like to coin it as like emotional obesity. I feel like it's an epidemic that is in all settings, not only the classroom setting. And so that feeling of being weighed down, lethargic, not inspired, not in the moment, like you were speaking about earlier, the effects of technology is really apparent in every classroom. And so this desire to tap into the soft skills and be able to just be able to manage yourself and be able to make responsible decisions despite all this stimulus being thrown at you seems to be increasing year after year. And the appetite for programs that teach mindfulness or teach connection, social emotional learning, is very high now because it's kind of an undeniable need in the classroom.
Let's go to your phone calls again. Gina is calling from Wrentham, Massachusetts. Gina, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead, Gina.
I'm going into high school this year, and I was just thinking about how you were talking earlier about social media and how people are always so obsessed with getting an amount of likes, amount of followers. And I think that we really just need to slow down. Like in school, it's all about how many followers you have, how popular are you. But I feel like we just need to take time and look towards, like, stop looking towards the future and, like, get back in touch with ourselves.
Gina, how old are you?
So, I'm 14.
And you're entering into what year in school?
Ninth grade.
Okay. Thank you for your call, Gina. Rupa, anything about the ninth grader who's just entering high school and this notion of emotional health? Not this ninth grader in particular. I'm talking about people of that age group.
No, and thank you, Gina, for sharing that. I mean, I love the awareness of how addictive technology is high among students and teachers. And I think that in order for a program to be successful in terms of understanding why am I making the choices I am on social media, who am I trying to be connected to? Am I taking this thought and putting it in a Snapchat or on Facebook or an email, or would it be better delivered in person or in a conversation face-to-face? And I think kind of doing the pros and cons of different, you know, outlets for your thoughts is something that is so beneficial for teenagers to do. You know, a private thought versus a public thought, what is the consequence of that? And I think that that's something that mindfulness can help lead pave the path for that, because if you don't know the end destination of the choices you're making, it's very hard to make smart choices. And that's what you need when you're thinking about social media.
Let's take one more call for you, Rupa. Jim is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, thanks for joining On Point.
Hi, Bud. Do you have any examples of mindfulness that students in higher education can use to avoid burnout? Thanks.
It's a good question. How about that, Rupa?
It's interesting. Throughout all our class settings, from kindergarten through 12th grade and teachers alike, I have found that the physical workouts have been the most rewarding thing for me to teach. We teach one-word workouts. So, for example, we would teach a proud workout, the happiness workout, the anger workout, and making that connection to an emotional state while you're doing a physical exercise can make such a difference. So if you're doing jumping jacks, that versus the energy workout, which could still be jumping jacks, causes you to think and reflect in the moment about what your body is feeling. And that simplicity can go a long way in your day and keep you focused. So I find that the physical workouts, are that low-hanging fruit, is the best entry level for any age.
Rupa, as we wrap up with you, if a teacher or a student anywhere in the country is listening to this and is intrigued by it, and perhaps wants to start a program akin to Nalini Kids in their school or school district, what can they do?
email us at connect, C-O-N-N-E-C-T, at nalinikids.org, and check out our website, nalinikids.org, for videos, grant information. We just started a grant where we're helping subsidize the costs of this program nationwide, and so we look forward to starting the conversation in any state.
Rupa Mehta is a fitness instructor and creator of the Nalini Kids program. Rupa, thank you as always for joining On Point.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Sure. You know, here's some sound from a video that we pulled by the Prison Mindfulness Institute. That's a group that leads mindfulness trainings for those who are incarcerated. You'll hear from Salim. He discusses how he uses mindfulness to get through his sentence at the John J. Moran facility in Rhode Island.
I don't have a release date, so I can only go home when they decide I can. So I learned to live day by day, and that helped me to deal with prison. And I could only do that being in the moment, being in the now.
Jon Kabat-Zinn, we turn back to you once again. Through the years, have you learned more about mindfulness and how it can be applied to different types of people? Or was that something you kind of grokked right from the start, that this could be something that would be helpful when used properly by anyone?
Well, I like the way you use the verb to grok. And yeah, it's that when you start practicing yourself and you do it as part of your actual ongoing everyday life, it makes a profound difference. And you begin to realize there's nothing special about me. Anybody could benefit from this in their own way if they were open to putting out the welcome mat that mindfulness really is, to attending, to your own experience on the level of the body, the level of thoughts and emotions, and the level of social interactions. So none of this is actually that surprising, but it's very, very gratifying to hear about this program in New York City and spreading across the country, as are many, many different mindfulness programs. And around the world, too. You've mentioned that several times. This is actually really a global phenomenon. And the reason that it's a global phenomenon is because the science supports it. There are studies at the Center for Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin that are going on now in a collaboration between the Department of Education in Madison, Wisconsin, the school system, and Richard Davidson's Laboratory of Affective Neuroscience, where they're actually studying the effects of training children in mindfulness and kindness and social connectedness from an early age, 5-year-olds and 7-year-olds and 9-year-olds, and then there are studies in the UK also looking at thousands of school children. These are more high school children who are training in mindfulness. That's a 7-year study, extremely well funded, and the results will be out in a few years. Teachers are dying to bring mindfulness into the classroom, because if you don't get your kids to pay attention, how can you get them to learn anything? Mm-hmm. And rather than yelling at kids to pay attention, wouldn't it make more sense to teach them how to pay attention? So let me just give you my working definition of mindfulness, since I never got around to it. It's awareness. And it's the awareness that arises through paying attention on purpose in the present moment and non-judgmentally. And I spoke some about what that really means. But that's a kind of a discipline. The real meditation practice is moment to moment, how you live your life. But that's easy to say. But as I said, it's almost the hardest thing in the world to do. So starting young and actually cultivating and exercising that muscle on a regular basis, it completely rotates how you actually understand who you are and how your life unfolds in relationship to the realities of life, some of which are extremely challenging.
Let's try to get a couple more calls in before the end of the segment. Michelle is calling from Richmond, Virginia. Michelle?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm enjoying the program. I'm calling. I'm actually in higher ed and use mindfulness in my classroom, but I'm calling in regard to utilizing mindfulness and meditation for cancer. I was diagnosed with invasive breast cancer and a brain tumor. And, my story about myself suddenly changed, and I had an interior narrative of fear and anxiety, and my head would be just turning and turning. And although I'd meditated for quite a while after I got the diagnosis at first, my husband and I took a walk, and we were discussing what was coming up. And I couldn't think of anything but hearing the words, "You have cancer." And my husband simply said, "Look at the sky. It's so blue." And I looked up, and it shook me out of my anxiety. Mm. And it was a revealing moment. And I used it all through chemotherapy and used it all through recovering from brain tumor surgery. And I found it really effective. When we talk about the medical effects of such things on your body, stress is really not your friend when you're dealing with cancer. And I found that as I felt like I was slipping away during chemotherapy and losing my life, it really helped me to be brought into the moment by being mindful of simple things, especially in nature.
Michelle, thank you so much for your phone call, and we obviously wish you the best of health. John, I've seen from a personal standpoint the positive effects of mindfulness in dealing with cancer. There's a great quote from one of the articles about you that says, and your quote is, "Mindfulness is not for the faint-hearted, nor for those who routinely avoid the whispered longings of their own hearts." How so?
Well, it goes straight to the heart, straight to the point. You know, we are complex beings, and we have many, many different aspects to ourselves. And very often when we're driving through our moments to get to better moments and fulfill all our desires or achievement goals or whatever it is, we miss the blue sky. We miss the look on our kids' faces. All of a sudden, they're like in their 20s or 30s. Where did their childhood go? We miss the people that often we're so busy that we miss the people we love the most, or we don't necessarily relate to them in the best way. So to be able to actually recognize that, this recognition factor of the human mind, to see the territory that you're actually inhabiting and realizing that we have choices, even if we're facing life-threatening conditions, life-threatening situations, that we can be in wiser relationship to the actuality of it. And that gives us freedom. It gives us a sense of safety. It gives us a sense of possibility that otherwise we just fall into anxiety and depression. And that's something that no pill can deliver. It's something that really, even people who love you the most can't get through to you unless you're willing to make yourself available to yourself.
There's the great old line from the great John Lennon song, "Life is what happens when you're busy making other plans."
Absolutely.
We have about a minute and a half left, John. Has mindfulness always worked for you, or for you, the person most synonymous with mindfulness, have there ever been times of struggle?
Oh, of course. I mean, mindfulness, the first thing you discover when you start to practice, seeing how long you can stay in the present moment, say even following, feeling your breath sensations in your body, the first thing you discover is how mindless you are. And believe me, it doesn't get less complicated when you stop formally meditating and go into the kitchen or into the bedroom or whatever it is. So as I was saying, the real practice is moment-to-moment awareness as life is unfolding. And it's not about like ever achieving some kind of perfection. If we idealize mindfulness and turn it into some special state, we're destroying it before we even taste it.
John Kabat-Zinn.
It's something that's intrinsic to us, and we can live inside it and be with whatever it is that's unfolding, good, bad, or ugly, what I sometimes call the full catastrophe of the human condition.
John Kabat-Zinn is professor of medicine emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Medical School and the creator of the mindfulness-based stress reduction program. His book, Falling Awake, How to Practice Mindfulness in Everyday Life. John, thank you so much for joining us on Point.
It's been my pleasure, Bud. My pleasure.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Bud Mishkin, and this is On Point.